Bertrand L. Comparé.
Tonight I thought I'd match the use of a new hall here with a little different subject matter, the Book of Job. Now, like a lot of things in your King James Version of the Bible, even the name is messed up. Actually, in the Hebrew, it's pronounced Eob, and you'll find in Moffat's translation, he spells it E-Y-O-B. Now, it happens that in the Latin language, when the letter J is used as the initial letter before a vowel, it has the sound of Y. And when they started translating out of the Latin, which was all the Catholic Church would allow as a language for the Bible for many centuries, when they started translating into English, why, they copied the Latin spelling. For example, you find the name of your Savior spelled J-E-S-U-S, and today we anglicize the pronunciation into Jesus. But there is, of course, no authority for it. In the Greek manuscripts from which they translated, it was spelled with the Greek letters corresponding to I-E-S-O-U-S and pronounced Jesus. Then, when the Catholic Church caused it to be translated out of the Greek into the Latin, they sometimes spelled it I-E-S-U-S and sometimes J-E-S-U-S, and in either case, they pronounced it Jesus. Then, when it was translated into English, as I say, the Latin spelling that the church hierarchy were accustomed to, that was used. Well, everybody calls him Job, so after that explanation, we'll call him Job for the rest of this lecture. Now, there are two Jobs mentioned in the Bible. And which one are we talking about? Well, one was a son of Issachar. Issachar was one of the 12 sons of Israel, the patriarch, and this son of Issachar must have been about 40 years old when Israel and his family went down into Egypt. So definitely that is not the one. He spent the rest of his life in Egypt. But this particular Job, we're told, lived in the land of Uz. Well, Uz was a grandson of Shem through Shem's son Aram. You'll find that mentioned in Genesis 10, verses 22 and 3. Uz settled in a region east of the Jordan River. This was beautifully fertile grass country, ideal grazing country for large herds of cattle and flocks of sheep. You remember that when the Israelites went through there on their way into Palestine, that the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, having great herds of cattle, asked that their share of the land be given them east of the River Jordan to stay in the beautiful grazing country. Now Job, we're told, had immense herds of cattle and flocks of sheep, so it was a suitable country for a cattle raiser to live in. Well, who is this Job, and when did he live? He appears in the Bible not just under that name of Job, but Jobab, J-O-B-A-B, meaning Father Job. And you will find that in Genesis 10, verses 22 to 29. Shem's son, Arphaxad, had two sons, a son, Eber. Eber had two sons, Peleg and Joktan, and Joktan's son was Jobab. Now, he lived back in the days when long life was the rule among the patriarchs, and you find reference to that in the book of Job. For example, Eliphaz the Temanite, one of these false friends who come to console him by telling him what a wicked scoundrel he must have been to be punished this way by all these troubles, Eliphaz mentions to him, "With us are both the gray-headed and the very aged man, much older than thy father." Now, as to when did he live? Besides the Bible chronology, which gives us a pretty good clue to this, he gives an astronomical clue. He mentions four stars or constellations in the four quarters of the heavens. Job 38, verses 31 and 2. "Canst thou bind the sweet influence of Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion? Canst thou bring forth Maseroth?" Literally, it's Egypt's star. It was the star Sirius as we know it today. "Canst thou bring forth Maseroth in his season, or canst thou guide Arcturus and his sons?" Now, astronomers calculate that those four were the two solstitial and the two equinoctial constellations about 2100 to 2136 BC, which would fit definitely the Bible chronology for the time of Job, identifying him as Jobab. The long life is evident. At the time of his troubles, Job had 10 children, all born by one wife, and all of his sons were married and had their own households. So that would make Job himself a minimum of 60 to 70 years old when the book begins. Couldn't have been less than that. And he also lived 140 years after his period of trouble. So, the book of Job is actually the oldest book in the Bible. It's not put first in the order in which the compilers put it together, but it is older than any of the writings of Moses. Now, it is a long philosophical discussion of righteousness or the lack of it and that sort of thing. And yet, while Job's friends, in quotes, are telling him how wicked he was and all the evil things he certainly must have done to bring these troubles on himself, never once do they accuse him of violating any of the laws as laid down by Moses. So certainly, this was written well before the laws of Moses were known. The book refers to Adam, to the fall of Adam, to the flood. There's no reference to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah in the time of Abraham. There's no reference to the law of Moses, no reference to the sojourn of the people of Israel in Egypt. So you know, therefore, the book was written before any of those things occurred. When it came to the matter of deciding which books were inspired and should be kept as sacred literature, the church was guided by the books that were accepted among the Jews as inspired literature, so far as the Old Testament was concerned, including making the mistake of including the book of Esther, which was a well-known fraud, and didn't belong in the Bible at all. But because the Jews accepted it, the church accepted it without apparently any substantial discussion of it. But from the beginning, from the earliest time the Hebrew canon of accepted inspired books was recognized, the book of Job was in it. Now, it's mentioned twice in Ezekiel, Ezekiel 14, verse 14, and Ezekiel 14, verse 20. Twice you find this statement of God himself to Ezekiel, speaking about the wickedness of Jerusalem and the punishment that was going to come upon it. God said, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver only their own souls by their righteousness, saith the Lord God. So there you find additional recognition of Job as a true historical character, and actually as good a man as the book tells us that he was. Then in the New Testament, James chapter 5, verses 10 and 11. I'm reading now from Smith and Goodspeed's translation, a little bit clearer. As an example, brothers, of ill treatment patiently endured, take the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Lord. Why, we call those who showed such endurance happy. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen that the Lord brought out of it, for the Lord is very kind and merciful. Now, as to that reference to the very old people, much older than Job's father, Heber, Job's grandfather, lived to be 464 years old, the Bible tells us. Noah lived to be 950 years old, and Shem lived to be 602. So these three definitely were still alive in Job's time, and they were probably these elders referred to by Eliphaz as men much older than Job's father. Now as to these friends who came to console him, Job's comforters, you know, has become a proverbial saying for people who like to crow over your misfortunes and tell you how wicked you must be to have this happen to you. One was Eliphaz the Temanite. That is, he was from Teman, a district in northern Edom. It means he was an Edomite Jew. Another was Bildad the Shuhite. Bildad means whom Bel loves. And you remember Bel was one of the pagan gods of Babylon. Shuhite means of the Canaanite clan of Shuah. See Genesis 38. Verses 2 and 12, 1 Chronicles 2, verse 3. And Zophar, the Naamathite. Now Naamah was the daughter of Lamech and Zillah, a sister of Tubal-Cain. So she was therefore in the line of Cain, and that places Zophar there, a descendant of Cain. Then, toward the latter part of the book, we suddenly meet a character who isn't introduced earlier than that, and he comes in with no introduction, no reason for him to be there. And scholars in general have been doubtful that this is part of the original book of Job. They have felt that it was something inserted by some later copyist. Elihu of the kindred of Ram, you cannot identify him by that. There is a ram mentioned in the Bible, but this would put the man, 600-800 years too late to be in the picture at all. So the ram he's related to must be some other one. Now you know how much difficulty there is today figuring out which John Smith you're talking about, because there's so many of them. And back in biblical days, when there were no family names at all, and you simply had a first name, and you're dealing with a population that exceeded a million at times, why, it's very likely that there would be more than one person with the same first name. So in trying to identify lineage this way, you always have to take note of the time factor also to see whether you're on the right track. Now, what about this book of Job, the earliest in point of time in the Bible? One of the most interesting things about it is that it is highly scientific, including some things that our scientists did not know until fairly recent times. For example, Job 26, verse 7, speaking of the great powers of God, he stretches out the north over the empty place and hangs the earth upon nothing. Now, 500 years ago, there were very few people you could convince that the earth didn't rest on something solid. The Hindus said that the earth rested on the back of an elephant. So what held the elephant up? Well, the elephant stood on the back of a big turtle. And when you asked them what supported the turtle, then they didn't know. The Greeks, so much wiser apparently, so proud of their intellectual power, they said that the earth was supported on the shoulders of the giant Atlas. But if you asked them what Atlas stood on, they couldn't tell you. And here in Job, he hangs the earth upon nothing. It just spins free in space. So that was anticipating our modern wise men by a great deal. Then that stretches the north over the empty place. All of you know, of course, that only a tiny portion of the stars are visible to the unaided eye. It doesn't take much of a telescope to bring out a great number of stars in places where the unaided eye sees only blank darkness. And of course, the big telescopes in the observatories see hundreds of thousands, many hundreds of thousands of stars that the eye cannot perceive. So when you run one of these big telescopes over places in the sky where the eye doesn't see anything, the telescope generally does. But there's one spot in the north where our powerful modern telescopes find just a blank black hole. There isn't anything visible there. So here in the book of Job, you are told that God stretched the north over the empty place. And that, again, is something that scientists couldn't have told you a century ago. Then the great heat deep in the earth. Job 28, verse 5. As for the earth, under it is turned up, as it were, fire. And our volcanic eruptions confirm that, certainly. Another thing that nobody would have believed a few centuries ago, Job 28, verse 25, speaking again of the powers of God, to make the weight for the winds, and he weigh up the water by measure. Well, the idea that the air had weight was something that was hotly disputed right down into the Middle Ages. I think it was Galileo, it was another scientist of about that period, if it wasn't Galileo, but one of them of about Galileo's time made a couple of great metal cups, half spheres, with their edges smooth so that they could fit together with a little gasket, airtight. And he weighed them. And then he pumped out all the air and he weighed them again. And he was able to find that the hollow sphere, empty, weighed a little less than when it was full of air. And that was the first time that our scientists could say that they knew that air had weight. Then again, Job 38, verse 25. Who hath divided a water course for the overflowing of water, or a way for the lightning of thunder? Now, within the last, less than 50 years, they have had high-speed movie cameras able to tell us a peculiar thing about lightning. As far as the eye is concerned, that one sudden, swift flash of lightning is all there is to it. But the high-speed camera, able to take thousands of pictures a second, showed us something different. Air is a very good insulator. It's hard for electricity to get through it. And something or other has to finally break down that resistance so the lightning bolt can go through. And first, occurring close to a second before the real flash, half a second or more, there is a little pilot flash that goes through, which ionizes the air so as to make it a conductor of electricity, and that little pathfinder flash makes the way for the lightning. Now all these bits of science you find in the book of Job. So when you're talking of things like this, it's obvious you are not talking about ignorant and superstitious people in that age. These were people who had a surprising amount of scientific knowledge. Now with that background, let's start examining the book itself. Job's character and conduct, we're told, were so good that God ranked him among the three best men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, and even called him a man so good there was no one like him on earth. Job 1, verses 6 to 12. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before him, and Satan came also among them. And God said unto Satan, Whence comest thou? Then Satan answered God and said, From going to and fro in the earth, and walking up and down. And God said unto Satan, Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth? A perfect and an upright man that fears God and eschews evil. Then Satan answered God and said, Doth Job fear God for naught? Hast thou not made a hedge about him and about his house and about all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. But put forth thine hand now and touch all that he has, and he will curse thee to thy face. And God said unto Satan, Behold, all that he has is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand. Now you know, of course, back in the third chapter of Genesis, Satan tempted Eve and then Adam by misrepresenting God as an unreasonable tyrant whom they couldn't respect, and they fell for it. Satan always tries to make trouble by misrepresenting God to man, but the Bible speaks of him as the accuser of our brethren, because until he finally was kicked out of heaven completely, He was always trying to make trouble by misrepresenting us to God. Always going with accusations, that were sharpened up a little more than the truth would bear, trying to stir up trouble. Now, the book starts out with a proposition that jars you considerably. On the testimony of God Himself, there is no fault in Job. God doesn't complain about anything Job has done. He praises him exclusively. And then Satan comes along and says, well, why not? You've paid him well for it. Look at all you're doing for him. But now if you take away a little of this prosperity of his, why, he'll curse you to your face. And God doesn't say, well, I know better than that. God says, well, all right, go ahead, Satan. You can't kill him. Don't harm him, but everything he owns is in your power. Now, the idea that God is sort of making a bet with Satan at the expense of Job as to how this thing will turn out, that's a pretty shocking thought to come up against, isn't it? Before we're through with the book, I think we're going to find a reasonable explanation for what otherwise seems like a problem. Well, now the book gives us a picture of Job as a very fine sort of man. He had a big family, 10 children, very fine family relationship. He was very proud of these children, loved them very much. So the first thing that Satan does when he's turned loose is not only to deprive Job of all of his property, but even his children. All 10 children killed, and all this happening in one day. Job had been a rich man, big herds, thousands of cattle, thousands of sheep, and that was the principal wealth in those days. Many servants. His servants were killed off, his cattle and sheep stolen, and even the house where all his children were gathered together for a feast, the house collapsed upon them and killed them all. Job was left suddenly a poor man, nobody but himself and his wife left, and Satan thought surely this would provoke a furious outburst of rage against God. But Job's only reply was this: naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So, since that didn't accomplish his purpose, God again reminded Satan on the next visit, here is Job. He said, you caused me to bring all these calamities on him without any cause. And still he's loyal. And Job said, oh, well, he got out of it with his skin. But now, touch him in his own person. Bring sickness and trouble upon him, and you will see that he'll curse you to your face. So God gives Satan permission to do even that. He just says you can't kill him, that's all. Now several kinds of sickness were suddenly brought upon Job through Satan's malice. And maybe not the most serious, but certainly the most annoying, he was covered with painful boils all over from head to foot. So he was not only sick and weak, but he was in misery day and night. Now, with that situation in its existence, three of these friends of his come, it says, to comfort him. Now, they had known him before in his prosperity. They had known what a fine man he was, and when they saw him in his condition of sickness as well as poverty, and said they were so astonished they just sat around with him, just unable to think of anything to talk about for a week. But they let it be known they had come to comfort him. Well, Job, with a good deal of justification, does complain of the situation he's in. He goes into some detail, and he said, "Why is this come upon me? I never violated the laws of hospitality that were so important in the Near East, especially in those times." He said, "The traveler never had to sleep out in the open. I took him into my house. I clothed and fed the poor. If any poor person's rights were being disregarded, I saw that he got justice. I did everything that was considered to be good and righteous." And now, what's the explanation for this? Look what's happened to me. This is more than just the ordinary misfortune. All these things must have come upon me by the hand of God laid upon me. And in fact, you could say that is correct. While the actual person who brought it about was Satan, God had said, "All right, Satan, go ahead and do it. You've got the power. I've given it to you." Now, Job is not able to understand this, and rightly. But his friends who came to comfort him, their comfort consists in assuring him what a wicked scoundrel he is. They say, "Why, nobody ever suffered any trouble except a justified retribution for his wrongdoing. Therefore, in spite of all our previous friendship with you and all we know about you, why, we know from your troubles how wicked you've been. You have stolen from the orphan and from the widow. You have turned away the stranger who needed some place to spend the night. You have moved the landmark so as to encroach your fields on your neighbors. You've done all these things, and now look what it's brought about you. Why don't you reform? You get out of this." Well, that's the sort of comfort some of our friends like to give us. Job, speaking of the troubles he's had, he mentions one thing that is perhaps worth noting here. Every once in a while, there is dug up a skeleton of some rather low type of person. Too far developed to be called just an ape, but not very much as considered against the background of today's humanity. And our self-admitted wise men say, "You see, that shows that back just a short time ago, man had not evolved yet." Well, I don't know if any of you have ever gone to the wrestling matches, but there are some characters wrestling whose appearance would certainly pass for that of a man of, say, 500,000 years ago, beyond any doubt. I remember one, I didn't see him myself, but I saw pictures of him, the Angel, they called him. And it took a rather charitable mind to consider him human. Now, this is here in our own times. He's probably still living now. But if his skeleton is dug up 500 years from now, some of our so-called scientists are going to say, "Well, you see, only 500 years ago, humanity hadn't really evolved yet." So as to these low-grade cavemen they speak of, here's what Job says. "But now, They that are younger than I have me in derision, men whose fathers I would have disdained to have set with the dogs of my flock. For want and famine they were solitary, fleeing into the wilderness in former time, desolate and waste, who cut up mallows by the bushes and juniper roots for their meat. They were driven forth from among men. They cried after them as after a thief. They went out to dwell in the cliffs of the valleys, in caves of the earth and in the rocks. Among the bushes they brayed, under the nettles they were gathered together. They were children of fools, yea, children of base men. They were viler than the earth. In other words, here were people in Noah's time from an inferior strain, degenerate, the same sort of caveman that our scientists like to find and say, look, this is all that existed of humanity, even that recently. But it's worthy of note that remains of rather high civilizations are found, which can be dated back just almost as far back as any of these so-called cavemen. So that they were, as Job pointed out, not representative of man in general, of their own kind, but at any time there had been some of these degenerate types, little above the animal. Well, in all these debates between Job and his friends, the great problem of good and evil is brought up. Why do the wicked actually prosper and the good suffer unmerited trouble? And it's never been more eloquently debated than in the book of Job. We might sum up the book briefly. In chapter 3, Job, bewailing his fate, says, why was I born? Why couldn't I have died at birth and been spared all this completely futile suffering? You can't tell me it's to teach me something. All it can teach me is that although I've been good, yet all this calamity comes upon me. So, why this? In chapter 4, his friend Eliphaz, gloating over this, self-righteous, he tells Job, well, you always taught others. When others were in trouble, why, you comforted them and so on, and he fails to mention you did something practical about it. But he says, when trouble comes upon you, why, you can't take it. Now, don't you remember? No innocent person ever suffered punishment. Hence, that shows you were wicked. Eliphaz says, I had a vision which informed me that everything is foul in God's sight. Job 4, verses 18 and 19. Behold, he puts no trust in his servants, and his angels he charges with folly. How much less in them that dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is the dust, which are crushed before the moth. And finally, since this doesn't seem to comfort Job very much, Eliphaz said, well, if I was in your case, why, I'd lay my case before God, ask him to vindicate me. But he bitterly condemns Job for doing just that. In chapter 15, verses 1 to 13, he rails at him. Why, you're telling God that you were actually good and you didn't deserve this. Why, that's blasphemy. So finally, Eliphaz sums it all up. Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, despise not thou the chastening of the Almighty. In other words, this is good for you, as long as it doesn't happen to me. Well, in chapter 6, Job replies in substance, my strength is gone, I'm not able to carry on a normal life now. It's better that I were dead. And you, my friends, why do you mock me like this in my trouble? In chapter 7, he says, I've lost all hope. Why does God oppress me so? And even if I have sinned, why doesn't he pardon me? So in chapter 8, another of these friends, Bildad, says, why, you hypocrite, if you were not wicked, God wouldn't punish you. But remember, the book has told us on the authority of God himself at the start that he hadn't done anything to deserve punishment. Well, this pious platitude, nobody ever gets into trouble unless he's wicked, that's too much for Job. So in chapters 9 and 10, he says, if I be wicked, why then do I labor in vain? Good question. Because the wicked do get material prosperity by their wickedness. So if I'm so wicked, why have I gone broke? And he goes on to state, the world is given into the hands of the wicked. The wicked and the good are destroyed alike. But, he said, I can't justify myself before God. He's too powerful an opponent to argue with. He's too strong. So in chapter 11, his third friend, Zophar, tells him, why, Job, you deserve worse than all this has happened to you. If you just stop doing evil now, you'll be all right. So in chapters 12, 13, and 14, Job said, everybody knows these platitudes that you speak. Why won't God at least let me die in peace? I'd wait for my resurrection. Job 14, verse 14. All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change has come. So even back there, the fact that resurrection was provided for man was known. Well, in chapter 15, Eliphaz comes back again. Now, Job has carried on a very eloquent philosophical discourse here, but Eliphaz says, well, we're